I am Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Continuing our story with campaign number 3, the New York Campaign, Phase 1, from August 26th to September 16th, 1776. And we pick up the story with the end of the battle at Staten Island in Brooklyn, where the British, under the command of the Howe brothers, defeated George Washington and the Patriots in late August 1776, less than 2 months after the signing of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia. While the battle for New York was a terrible drubbing for Washington's troops, the loss was not complete. Indeed, it could have been catastrophic for the Americans if the British had immediately pushed their success. British General Henry Clinton believed the numerous works and trenches built by George Washington's men opposite Manhattan, New York, were only occupied by 800 men, over an extent he considered as needing over 7 times the amount to be adequately defended. "I had at that moment," Clinton wrote later, "but little inclination to check the ardor of our troops when I saw the enemy flying in such a panic before them. I was also not without hope that His Excellency General William Howe, who was on a neighboring hill and of course saw their confusion, might be tempted to order us to march directly down the road to the ferry, by which, if we succeeded, everything on the island must have been ours." To be fair, neither General Howe nor General Clinton of the British could have known with any certainty how many American troops manned the fortifications, and Clinton's estimate was well below the thousands Washington actually had there. The most recent major battle General Howe had fought, on a fortified hill outside Boston in June 1775, had cost the British some 900 killed and wounded, losses that could not be easily replaced. General Howe freely admitted in his official report that the American works could have been carried by his troops, whom he had to prevail upon to desist from the attempt. But as was apparent, the lines must have been ours at a very cheap rate by regular approaches. I would not risk the loss that might have been sustained in the assault. The days following the battle featured heavy rain and minor skirmishing between the light troops of each side. Washington was perhaps not thrilled with the former, but welcomed the latter, hoping it would give his shaken troops some renewed confidence. This allowed for some time to count up the losses and inform the Continental Congress of his defeat. No one could accurately tabulate the casualties, however, and Washington held out hope that many of the missing would return into the lines. 4 days after the battle, John Hancock and Congress were informed that the loss to the American army in killed, missing, and prisoners was perhaps between 700 and 1,000 officers and men. The actual losses were nearly twice that. A British return made out after the battle, in fact, tallied 1,097 American officers and men taken prisoner, 67 of whom were wounded. Among the prisoners were Continental Generals John Sullivan and Lord Stirling, along with wounded New York Militia Brigadier General Nathaniel Woodhull, who would die in Utrecht within a few weeks. The capture and death of the last-mentioned officer, Nathaniel Woodhull, remains a mystery to this date, steeped in legend and lore of a defiant patriot. According to the common report of the time, Woodhull was wounded in the hand and arm for not turning over his sword to the British. The Americans grasped for glimmers of success. In one instance, a captured officer's hat marked Grant led to reports of the death of British General James Grant in the battle. The hat actually belonged to Lieutenant Colonel James Grant of the 40th Regiment of Foot of the British Army, who was indeed killed in action. The general, General Grant, who was still alive and well, related the fact to a friend in England, stating, "Those cursed saints put me in the newspapers as being killed, and rejoiced exceedingly at getting rid of a man who had abused them in Parliament. The Americans would have to settle for a lieutenant and 21 British Marine grenadiers who mistook a well uninformed, uniformed party of blue-coated Continentals for German Hessians and ended up as their prisoners. The number of American dead and wounded was never ascertained, with estimates ranging from 500 to 1,800 soldiers. With the imminent danger of the British Royal Navy cutting off reinforcement or evacuation, George Washington convened a council of war to discuss the situation and formulate the next step. The wind had so far prevented the British warships from advancing up the East River across from Manhattan, but that would not last much longer. The heavy rain had ruined ammunition and provisions. Above all, the defeat on the 27th of August had caused great confusion and discouragement among the troops. The eight generals present unanimously voted in favor of immediately evacuating the troops to New York City. The American evacuation proceeded as quietly as possible. Soldiers helped those in need of assistance, such as Pennsylvania Rifle Ensign George Ouray, who wrote, "We crossed over in the night from Long Island to New York. I had received in the battle a flesh wound in my right thigh, made with the saber of a British light horseman when they broke our ranks, and lay in one of the wagons on account of weakness from the loss of blood until the proper time for embarking when the men carried me to the boat." The crossing from the fortifications on Brooklyn Heights to Manhattan was aided by both nature and man. With a heavy fog rolling in off the water, small craft with muffled oars went unheard and unseen by the British, ferrying George Washington's troops to safety. The men doing the rowing were primarily from one corps, raised in the vicinity of Marblehead, Massachusetts, that being the 14th Continental Regiment commanded by Colonel John Glover. Colonel Glover and his men miraculously evacuated the entire remaining American force in Brooklyn, perhaps over 8,000 men, for which they received the thanks of all the generals for the attention, dispatch, and regularity which they manifested throughout the whole night. One Connecticut soldier summed it up well when years later he recalled that, "While the enemy was yawning, we were quietly paraded and drawn off." The scale of the American defeat could not remain secret forever. The New York Gazette and the Weekly Mercury for September 9, 1776, published a list of captured officers who had requested their baggage and money be sent to them as prisoners. It included dozens of names, principally Colonel Samuel Miles and Daniel Broadhead's Pennsylvania Riflemen, Samuel Attlee's Pennsylvanians, William Smallwood's Marylanders, and Jedediah Huntington's 17th Continental Regiment. The paper likewise informed its readers that a flag of truce came from the British fleet with the return of those officers that were made prisoners in the late attack on Long Island, who we hear are treated with civility by the British officers. On August 29, 1776, General Lord Stirling wrote to George Washington from aboard the British ship HMS Eagle to inform him that he had been taken prisoner by the German Hessians under General von Heister. His fellow Continental general in captivity probably carried Stirling's letter personally to George Washington. On August 29th, General Sullivan came up on his parole and confirms the account of General Lord Stirling and the greatest part of our men that were missing being prisoners and very humanely treated. He returned on board that evening, but came up again next morning and set out immediately afterwards to the Congress at Philadelphia, he wrote. Within a few days, there would actually be far fewer prisoners in British hands. Among those serving with the British were recruiters from the Royal Highland Immigrants, a Loyalist regiment then stationed in Nova Scotia, commanded by Major John Small. On September 3rd, Major Small ordered the Maryland Loyalist Robert William Walker to go among the rebel prisoners to try what number he could enlist for the regiment, when he enlisted 173 men and took them all safe. to Halifax, Nova Scotia. Sullivan had specifically been paroled to bring a message to the Continental Congress on behalf of British Admiral Lord Howe, wishing the two sides to meet to discuss peace. The Continental Congress agreed, sending three delegates, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Edward Rutledge. The meeting took place on September 11th at the home of Loyalist Colonel Christopher Billup on Staten Island, New York. The outcome was preordained, as the issue of independence could not be negotiated. In the words of British Lord Howe Secretary Ambrose Serrell, they met, they talked, they parted. The war would continue. The remainder of the New York campaign, despite American bravado and the numerous fortifications dotting the New York area, was a foregone conclusion. Manhattan was still an island, and without a proper American Navy to defend the surrounding waterways, the British could place troops when and where they wished. General John Morin Scott knew all too well what would happen when he wrote George Washington on August 31st, stating, "I have very little apprehension that the enemy will attempt to land in the city while we are here, as I think they can drive us out of it without that risk, and we never, I am convinced, can prevail on the troops to stand a bombardment and cannonade." New York City was completely untenable. Manhattan Island is just over 2 miles wide, meaning any retreat from the city could be easily blocked, unless fortifications and disciplined troops existed in such numbers as to prevent the British landing. They did not. On September 15th, thousands of British and Hessian troops pushed off from Newtown, Long Island, into the East River towards Manhattan, protected by five Royal Navy frigates in Kipps Bay. Ahead of them, from the quiet of the water, the British saw breastworks filled with men and columns of troops advancing to reinforce them. Germans in the boats sang hymns. British troops cursed. On command, the British ships opened fire on the Americans. They began the most tremendous peal I have ever heard, one British officer wrote, stating the breastworks were blown to pieces in a few minutes, and those who were there to have defended it were happy to escape as quick as possible through the neighboring ravines. The American columns broke instantly and betook themselves to the nearest woods for shelter. We pressed ashore, landed, and formed without losing a single man. Although the men of Douglas's Brigade of Connecticut Militia, the troops tasked with manning the breastworks for the Americans, fled despite the exhortations of George Washington and his staff to hold the line, the defeat could have been much worse. Despite wishing to hold the city, Congress allowed Washington leave to evacuate, staying there not a moment longer than he shall think it proper. This gave Washington time to remove vital stores, march off the bulk of his troops, and start building new works on the northern tip of Manhattan. Despite the British not extending their line across the island before the bulk of the American army escaped, another 371 officers and men fell into British hands, along with ordnance and stores that had not yet been removed. While New York City had fallen into British hands and would remain the headquarters for their army in America all the way through November 1783, they would not enjoy all of it, at least not as it stood when Washington left it. As far back as July 27, 1776, Cortland Skinner, a New Jersey loyalist, then raising a regiment for the British, opined, "'Tis probable the New Englanders will burn the town to prevent its being a station for us." It is still debated today what happened and by whose hand, but soon after midnight on September 21, 1776, flames erupted in New York City, devouring such landmarks as Trinity Church. Enraged residents, soldiers, and sailors sought not only to douse the flames, but to catch the perpetrators as well. Rumors swirled of arsonists being caught with combustibles and others cutting the handles of leather fire buckets. Such as were apprehended were said to have received summary justice on the spot. When the flames were finally extinguished, over 10% of the city had burned to the ground, principally between Broadway and the Hudson River. For the next 2 months, George Washington and British General Howe continued the campaign, with the British again leapfrogging forward from their shipping, first at Throg's Neck, and then on October 18th at Pell's Point, a few miles to the northeast on Long Island Sound. The men under John Glover, the 3rd, 13th, 14th, and 26th Continental Regiments, once again did great service to the cause of American independence, holding off a superior British force, five times their number, giving George Washington time to remove his remaining forces from below that point and redeploy into Westchester, New York. The two sides maneuvered around until fighting an inconclusive battle at White Plains, New York, on October 28, 1776. The end of October saw the Americans in possession of Fort Washington, commanding Kingsbridge and northern Manhattan, along with its sister post, Fort Lee, to the southwest across the Hudson River in New Jersey. Over the past 4 months, the British had occupied all of Staten Island, Long Island, New York City, and Paulus Hook. In November, Washington divided his forces, leaving New York and New England troops in the Hudson Valley and upper Westchester, New York, while personally leading the troops from New Jersey and southward to take post at Fort Lee and Bergen County in New Jersey. Fort Washington, heavily defended by troops from Pennsylvania and New England, under Colonel Robert McGaw, appeared to be safe from further British interests. Most American officers thought the campaign season was over and the fighting done until spring. Writing to his wife on November 10th, Artillery Commander Henry Knox said, "This campaign, I think, may be termed a losing campaign. Not that I think the enemy have gained infinite advantages over us. It has been a tragic comedy of errors on both sides." To the surprise of George Washington and his staff, however, the British were not done. On November 15th, they summoned Colonel McGaw and Fort Washington to surrender, and they were refused. The wiser response would have been to evacuate the garrison to New Jersey, as it could no longer be safely supported. American General Nathanael Greene, however, commanding at Fort Lee, instead chose to double the troops in Colonel McGaw's post, a decision that would come back to haunt him. The day following McGaw's refusal to surrender to the British, a large force of British and Hessians, the latter led on by Lieutenant General Wilhelm von Knyphausen, attacked and quickly captured the fort, which was renamed in honor of the Hessian commander. Over 2,800 officers and men were captured, virtually the entire American garrison. George Washington could only watch helplessly from Fort Lee. Washington perhaps thought this action had closed the campaign, but he made the prudent decision to start evacuating the large stock of provisions and stores from Fort Lee prior to abandoning it. The fort, intended to be used in conjunction with Fort Washington in blocking the Hudson River to the British Royal Navy, was now useless. It had never actually stopped British ships from sailing past, despite withering fire from the heavy guns at each post. On November 20, 1776, just 4 days after the fall of Fort Washington, and before the latest evacuation could be completed, 5,000 British and Hessian troops under Lord Cornwallis landed unopposed about 6 miles above the American Fort Lee. Thanks to the alertness of a lieutenant in Hurd's brigade on guard duty, the American garrison was warned and able to cross the Hackensack River at New Bridge to the west, thereby escaping entrapment. The British captured the post with virtually all its artillery, tent standing, and breakfast on the fire without firing a shot. The British had taken 4,430 officers and men prisoner since that August day in Brooklyn. Washington and his divided army now faced defeat in detail by the recently knighted Sir William Howe. As pamphleteer Tom Paine, who marched with George Washington troops, would write, "These were times that tried men's souls. The Americans would need a major reversal of fortune to achieve their cause of independence, and soon." This is the end of the essay on campaign number 3, and this begins campaign number 4, the New York campaign, phase 2, from September 17th to November 22nd, 1776, and the retreat through the Jerseys and the Battle of Trenton, November 20th to December 26th, 1776. The times that try men's souls, the crossing, and the 10 crucial days. Following their daily routine, Thomas Clark and his sister Sarah, along with their enslaved woman Susanna, awoke early on Friday morning, January 3rd, 1777, on their farm located about a mile south of the village of Princeton, New Jersey. Beginning their chores, they unexpectedly heard and then saw a long column of Continental soldiers and militiamen marching up the little-used dirt road that passed a short distance from their front door. As they watched, about 300 soldiers turned left from the column and marched across the crop stubble of the Clark's frozen farm fields and towards the bare orchard on their brother William's farm. These peaceful Quakers watched an intense battle flare up when the American troops encountered about 400 to 500 British troops coming towards them. After an hour of heavy combat on their farm, as the battle sounds became more distant, Thomas and Sarah's relief changed to shock grief when some American soldiers came to their door carrying several wounded, heavily bleeding men, including one identified as a high-ranking officer. The Quaker siblings accepted these wounded men into their home for treatment, knowing that there were more wounded and dead lying in the fields who also needed help. This battle took place during the times that Thomas Paine described as trying men's souls, but also at a moment of transition. For on December 25th, 1776, the war for independence had all but seemed lost. Just 10 days later, however, the American patriots had gained a feeling of renewed confidence that their cause was just and they could succeed. Simultaneously, the British and their loyalist supporters began questioning their ability to win. After abandoning Fort Lee on the northeast edge of New Jersey in mid-November 1776, George Washington's army retreated across New Jersey, pursued by a British force commanded by Lord Charles Cornwallis. The ordinarily aggressive Cornwallis followed Washington's troops with restraint, as ordered by his commander, British General William Howe, who wore a second hat as a peace commissioner and felt the war was essentially over. General Howe's restraint allowed Washington to reach Trenton, New Jersey, and use its ferries and other boats to cross the Delaware River to Pennsylvania during the first week of December. George Washington took aggressive action to remove any boats the British could use to cross the river after him and move against Philadelphia. He dispersed his troops among posts established in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, for over 20 miles along the Delaware River, from Coryell's Ferry, today New Hope, in the north to Bristol in the south. If British troops somehow found boats and tried to cross the river at any point, they would encounter American troops ready to resist and quickly spread the alarm. Stymied, British General Howe decided to end the campaign and establish winter quarters, assigning troops to a string of cantonments across New Jersey. About 1,500 Hessians under Colonel Johann Rahl manned the westernmost post at Trenton, New Jersey, and another 1,500 Hessians and British under the command of Colonel Carl von Dunop were stationed in the Bordentown, Burlington area. This arrangement put much of central New Jersey, along with the New York City area, under apparently firm control of the largest expeditionary force ever assembled by Britain. The young New York Jersey state government ceased functioning, and American patriots felt abandoned, while British loyalists felt empowered and protected by the British army. The British recognized the low rebel morale and hoped that the loyalists could help them against the American rebels. For the next 2.5 weeks, small bands of patriot troops crossed the Delaware River on a near daily basis to harass the British troops at both western points. This prevented the British and Hessian troops at these posts from settling into winter quarters, recovering from the fatigue and illnesses of the fall campaign, repairing equipment, and receiving fresh clothing and shoes. The soldiers felt that they were still on campaign, not standing down in winter quarters. Sickness increased, in addition to wounds and violent deaths. In the Trenton area, groups of 50 or fewer militiamen and Continentals carried out harassing attacks against the British. Hessian outposts, foraging parties, messengers, and patrols experienced hit-and-run skirmishes that took a mental as well as a physical toll. In the area south of Trenton, around Bordentown, Burlington, Moorestown, and Mount Holly, a series of skirmishes occurred during the week before Christmas. At Moorestown, Virginian Colonel Samuel Griffin gathered a small group of Virginia artillery and about 500 New Jersey militiamen from Cumberland, Salem, and Gloucester counties. Griffin arrived at Mount Holly on December 20th and found that the British had abandoned it, leaving supplies behind and fires burning. Griffin sent out after the British, but local loyalists kept the British informed of his progress. The British had about 700 men and 3 cannon at Black Horse. Reading about campaign number 4, The Times That Try Men's Soul, The Crossing and the 10 Crucial Days, will be continued. This is Wallace Klunkingst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.